Hello and welcome to our podcast. Today we will be discussing how the media is used to portray social movements by exploring two cases, the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States and the 2020-2021 farmers' protest in India. We'll be comparing the various forms of media these two movements used and looking at their depiction of violence, outreach, and general effectiveness. But first, let's introduce our speakers.
I am Buhiza. I am a CU student in culture, politics, and society. I'm from Kosovo, and I'm so excited to be in this podcast.
Awesome. I'm Alex. I am a philosophy, politics, and economics student here at CU in my second year, and I'm from the U.S.
And I'm Sky. I'm a CPS, Culture, Politics, and Society major at CEU in my second year, and I'm also from the U.S.
All right. Let's talk about one of the biggest movements in recent Indian history, the farmers' protest. It all kicked off in late 2020s when the Indian government introduced three new farm laws. They were marketed as reforms to modernize agriculture, but farmers saw them as a threat. They were worried that these laws would weaken the safety net that they would rely on, like the minimum support price system. And essentially, they feared being left at the mercy of big corporations. Now, here's the thing. These laws were passed pretty quickly without much consultation, which made farmers even more angry. So by November 2020, tens of thousands of farmers started camping out at the borders of Delhi. And when I say camping, I mean for over a year in harsh winters through summers, in any conditions, they were there. These protests were massive. They included tractor rallies, peaceful sit-ins, and a ton of online support. In fact, the movement even caught some global attention, which we will discuss later. But despite all this, talks between the government and farmers kept hitting a wall. The farmers had one demand: to repeal the laws. And finally, after a year of protest, the government announced in November 2021 that they would repeal the laws. And by December, the laws were officially scrapped and the protest came to an end. So what's the takeaway here? This wasn't just about farm laws. It was about farmers standing up for their livelihoods and pushing back against what they saw as corporate overreach. And in the end, it showed the sheer power of collective action.
Awesome. Thanks so much for the great summary, Pui. Moving on to the second case that we're going to be looking at, the Black Lives Matter movement. We can really consider that the Black Lives Matter movement started in 2013, but regained as significance and importance in 2020 with the death of George Floyd. And this led to this video of George Floyd dying went completely viral and eventually led to sort of the revival of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2022, calling for an end to police violence, systemic racism, and racial inequality. We saw this movement really begin in the U.S., especially using social media and the hashtag Black Lives Matter hashtag. But it also spread to around the world, reaching UK, where we saw some significant changes that we're going to talk about. Well, some maybe significant changes we're going to talk about, as well as some changes within the U.S. and the system there.
All right. Thank you for that recap. Now, let's refresh the types of media that are involved in these movements, because there's a growing range of outlets, from classic television, news, radio, and newspapers to now the newer short-form social medias such as Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. As media is used to serve as a bridge between the government and the people, through these medias, we can see how different engagement from either side affects it differently. Depiction of violence is one of the ways to explore each of their characteristics and how they support each narrative that is formed. And even more so, we can explore how they are able to reach beyond borders and make cultural impacts worldwide.
I mean, for India, they mostly use traditional media, and I'm speaking of newspapers, TV, and they use journalists. But the problem was that these were all corporate-owned and paid by the government. And this causes many difficulties. And this was a huge, like, the main problem of how media was portraying the protest, because media was essentially, right hand of the government. And it's losing, in my opinion, the entire point of having a discussion, which is just presenting different points of arguments. And some Indian citizens in some interviews even interpreted media as just a platform for the prime minister to give his speeches when there is no public questions of the prime minister in media at all. The farmers also argue that the media focuses on the urban areas only, and for the India, this is a huge difference between rural and urban areas. And of course, the citizens needs media to portray both sides, but the media was focused very much on the urban side. But then some journalists explained that this is it's not easy to be a journalist in India and to speak up because you experience a lot of threats, attacks, and even there were some murders of journalists. So automatically, in my opinion, the discussion of communication and media brings us back to politics. Depending on the political regime, media can be either a platform for citizens to raise their voice, or media will blame citizens and be entirely one-sided in support of the government. That's why I think the farmers movement in India was focused in expressing the activism through actions and less through media, because this was less possible. Mm. By going into the streets, sleeping there, camping there, and they sort of gave up on trying to be the first page of the news. This was impossible, how they tell. They had some social media support as well, especially by some celebrities like Rihanna or Greta Thunberg, who posted tweets about it. But we'll see that they did not like this interference. Like in India, it wasn't much appreciated to be interfered by the international actors. Compared to if we look at the US, for example, the Black Lives Matter, in how I received it, it all started online. It all started from a video and it went to the street. And I mean, the fact that it started with a video, it's really an important aspect to consider, because there's the visual, the psychological effects of a video compared to when you just read a title in a newspaper. And of course, these movements have different content, and a video of a farmer working hard wouldn't get that much attention. That's why it's also interesting to compare the two, and that's why we're choosing these two. So the use of video was already a strong indicator to start with, and it's easier to spread out, it's easier to understand what is going on, compared to the farmers complained about the bill, which you would have to read a bit more. So video is already digital, and then they use social media platforms such as Instagram and Twitter, but specifically hashtags, to share more and more what is going on. And 3 days after George died, the hashtag Black Lives Matter have been shared 8.8 million times. And in those names, the name of George Floyd was searched more than coronavirus, for example, or Donald Trump. And I mean, this is just an insane number of targeted people in such a short time, which traditional media, I think, would never could have reached. And then Black Lives Matter then initiated other hashtags such as Say Her Name or Blackout Tuesday or Me Too. But especially for Blackout Tuesday, there was a huge discussion if this is the right form of activism or not.
Yeah, and maybe just jumping in on these engagement posts, we see that there's actually a lot of criticism surrounding engagement mm-hmm. posts that are so easily accessible to media users. So this, what Pui referred to as Blackout Tuesday, was merely just anyone and everyone who was wanting to sort of support the Black Lives Matter movement posting a photo of just a black screen on their Instagram or whatever social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter. And we can consider this certainly support for the movement, but the criticism comes down that this isn't really that effective, that a post of a black square is actually not doing that much for the movement. And I think this in general is a really harsh criticism of Black Lives Matter, because although there was a lot of supporters, there was sort of a very weak support. The gate to entry for support was very easy. Mm-hmm. And so the support given was in many terms unsubstantial, right? Like we could, instead of sharing information or instead of sharing maybe a link or an email that you could send, you know, your support for the Black Lives Matter movement and get real systematic change, we saw a lot of really shallow interactions on social media. And this wasn't the case, as Pui mentioned, in India, because there was a much greater desire to, or not desire, but just kind of under the circumstances of media in India, there was a much more physical participation in protests and a much kind of higher gate to entry. You had to actually go out, you had to stop farming mm-hmm. and protest along the streets. Whereas in the US, in Black Lives Matter, you could sit mm-hmm. on your couch, you post a black screen, you feel like you've done something, you feel like you've supported the movement.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what makes Black Lives Matter a really good thing to look at because it is distinctly a social media movement. This is like saying that the main core of everything that made it have momentum and gave its results is all done through social media. And it's really something that's important to consider when you think of other movements such as Me Too, which were also solely social media movements. And in a general sense, when we think of social media as becoming a news source, it means it's going beyond the original intention of being a source of entertainment. But through this original source of entertainment, it's still given this new political responsibility, but it just delivers that news through the lens of entertainment. And this is manifested in the sense of like eye-catching and controversial information being delivered and pushed towards the consumer and leaving behind like the proper context and knowledge that would go along with it, which means that lots of like strong emotionally driven opinions are given and formed without having a well-rounded stance, which in the case of Black Lives Matter, it was these emotionally disturbing exposés that gave its traction and caught the consumer's attention, which is what brought it to blow up so fast, as Fujisa was talking about. And in this sense, social media was the perfect outlet for Black Lives Matter to have its mission completed, because with the emotional hook, it led people to researching more. But there's also the drawbacks of that, which we'll discuss later, with the lack of actual effective results because of the easiness that interaction can come with it.
Yeah, I mean, there is an activist about this, Sandy Hudson, who criticizes a lot. She was super involved with the Black Lives Matter, how to portray this and how to make people more engaged with it. And we discussed it has its pros. It has its pros because I was even like super far from the US in Kosovo. I was super engaged because this was everywhere in social media. And I felt like, yeah, I felt like it's affecting me. And I was personally very, very devoted to this in my social media accounts, like Instagram especially. But this activist, Sandy Hudson, was criticizing and arguing that this is oversimplifying and it's not addressing the actual needs or request of the movement. She says it's too easy to post a black picture and that doesn't say much. And she was critiquing, like, instead of posting this black square, you should post something like defund the police or mental health emergency services are a must or something that really mm-hmm. requires action. And I think that was quite different from India.
Yeah, I mean, Pui, maybe you can touch a bit on why India didn't want sort of this international interaction that Black Lives Matter did ask for.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, actually. Like, media in the US, like, whatever happens in the US is why super easily spread out and everyone in the world knows about it. Compared to the farmers' movements, I never heard about it. But when Rihanna started to post about it in Twitter and Greta Thunberg, some people in India went to the streets and actually had their posters with the face of Rihanna, Greta Thunberg being burned or being scratched or saying, no international interference, we don't want you to tell us what to do. And I'm pretty sure these were people in supportive of the government. And I think this is how government controls everything. When you control the media, then the media is portraying these kind of protests. And speaking of how the media in India portrayed protest, it's super important how much it gave space to the violence of it compared to the actual to the actual peaceful way that they did violence.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't even start covering it until 3 days after the protest had begun, until they started doing things that would elicit like a violent image. So
yeah, precisely.
It completely skewed the narrative to fit what they wanted to portray.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think just on that topic, before we move on to violence in each of these cases, because we see violence in both Black Lives Matter and the India farmers protest, I think that India's control of the media really allowed it to stay far away from international pressure. And although we don't know the exact effects of international pressure on any state, we do know that there is an international pressure and a soft power that states do have to sort of take into account when developing policies or responding to social movements, especially states like India, which argue very diligently that they are a democracy. And that maybe is called into question in mm-hmm. cases like the farmers' protest if they're not listening to their people and their protesters. But anyways, moving on to...
I just wanted to go on that. It's definitely, it surpassed just the original protest of fighting for their rights, and then it became something of defending the democracy within India.
Yeah, exactly. It's very interesting. Yeah, so I think we touched briefly on the violence in each case. I think to kind of summarize how violence was portrayed in each of these movements, starting, or not portrayed, but just what occurred, starting with Black Lives Matter, there was a lot of protests that became violent, and although not necessarily violent towards people, sometimes towards police officers, certainly violent towards the surrounding areas. So the buildings, the businesses, there was a lot of looting, there was a lot of graffiti on these walls, and business owners in the U.S. particularly were very upset about this, and it kind of, a lot of ways, turned them against the Black Lives Matter movement. Like, I heard a lot of people, for example, in just my surroundings in the U.S. saying, I agree with the cause, I agree with Black Lives Matter, but the way that these protests are going about, you know, like, that's not a good way to do things, and that's pushing me away. And so in Black Lives Matter, that was a really huge contention point. We see sort of a different case in India, where although a majority of the protests were quite peaceful, there was a very significant moment where the protests had marched to, I think, the capital, or a significant location in India, and hoisted the separatist flag up onto the building illegally. And this sort of violence was really focused on in the media. So the protests were conveyed really as aligned with the separatist movement, rather than being, you know, a march in which farmers were stopping work and marching down the streets. It was rather, look at what these violent protesters have done. They have looted, they have destroyed our buildings, and they've hoisted the separatist flag, and they're a threat to our state and to our legitimacy.
Yeah. And in India, it was the large majority of protesters that went down to New Delhi, which is a little bit different from in Black Lives Matter, because it was really like two separate kinds of protesters. It's oftentimes, it's not like a peaceful protester will all of a sudden decide that they need to now loot because it'll be more impactful. It's usually two separate paths that they tend to take. And a lot of times the looters' motivation is a way of like reclaiming their dignity against the government that they feel has been taken from them. And so for them to have an impact, looting is important. And it's oftentimes from the poor sides, and it's seen like as a chance to balance the scales. But obviously this context and like perspective isn't taken when you're just looking at a video of like mass destruction, and instead like the violence speaks louder than any of the motivation behind it. And then, as Alex was saying, it steers people away from believing in the movement and becoming less understanding of what the cause is fighting for. It kind of loses its core. And so, yeah, in the sense of Black Lives Matter, when it started getting more violent and people were watching these videos of mass destruction, and also in a time of coronavirus where like leaving the house was already technically a violation of some form of human dignity because it was risking health. So even the peaceful protesters were in some way facing backlash of like putting people at health risk. So the destruction of looting is like another level to that was able to be like manipulated and formed into this narrative of like, look at these violent people that are fighting, like we're not going to side with them. So it kind of backfired a lot for those reasons.
Mm-hmm. But media in general, like not only these two cases, but media just seems to thrive on negativity. Like every time I turn on the news or scroll through my feed, it's just filled with dramatic, often this unsettling stories, especially when it comes to protests. Like there's actually a lot of psychology behind this. First off, we humans are programmed with something called negativity bias, and it's this evolutionary thing where our brains prioritize bad news over good. Why? Because back in the days, it helped us survive. Being hyper-aware of threats kept people alive. And even today, negative images like violent protests or destruction naturally grab our attention more than, say, a peaceful march. But it's not just our brains doing this on their own. The media plays a crucial role in this. Because let's face it, dramatic, conflict-driven stories are more engaging. They're easier to frame as good guys versus bad guys, and that just keeps people watching, clicking, and sharing, which is exactly what media wants for their ad revenue. And there's the visual impact. Negative photos, think burning cars, angry crowds, clashing police, are intense and just stay with you, and they hit you emotionally and are way more memorable than peaceful or neutral imagery. And in the fact that social media algorithms love everything that stirs the pot, and boom, you're stuck in this loop of negativity. And here's the interesting part. For some people, seeing these negative images might spark action. They might feel empathy or anger and think, I need to do something about this. But then for some others, it's exactly the opposite. It's like emotional overload. They get desensitized or just check out entirely. So why does media focus on negative scenarios? It's just a mix of psychology, their own profit, and the way that us, like we viewers, react to it.
And yeah, this ties back to news being delivered in an entertainment format. I mean, a lot of us are getting this information passively through scrolling, and we're not actively searching a news source and looking at the television and sitting down with a mindset ready to receive information. Oftentimes it's coming to bombarded in between other irrelevant posts. And especially when it's something really violent, a lot of us have gotten to the point where we're either feeling completely desensitized to it and scrolling past because of a lack of ability to get into that right now, because we're not choosing to then and there. And that leads to just kind of a surplus of these videos and not much interaction that actually leads to any kind of change. So,
yeah, but then I'm thinking with myself, if you don't portray the exact violence or how serious it, are you really portraying the reality of the protest? Like, if I would be a journalist, I would try maybe to portray less of violence, so in order to people not feel this desensitization. But then if I'm not portraying what is actually happening, I'm kind of undermining this movement, and I'm saying maybe this is not as important, or I'm not portraying the reality of it. Because let's be real, Black Lives Matter and Indian both were very serious, very sometimes aggressive, sometimes violent. And if we're not portraying, are we really portraying what's happening?
I mean, yeah, I think that journalists have the obligation to portray exactly what's going on within a protest. And you can't ignore the violence. So it, but we do know that, as Pui said, media is negatively biased. So I think that the violence often gets overplayed, not through the journalists, but through the newer forms of media that we're seeing. Like, yes, the news articles certainly capitalize on it, and they did in India's case, but this is done to an exponentially greater extent within social media, where it is driven entirely by capitalism. I mean, it's an entertainment industry. They're wanting to make revenue, and they know that the way that they make revenue is by roping people into the negative. I mean, I think everybody listening probably can think about their own social media and can think about, like, how many videos do you see of maybe cute cats or something. We've all get them. They're great. They're lovely. But you don't get that many videos of peaceful protests. You get videos of negative and violent protests. And that's really the skew we're looking at. What grabs our attention? The cute cats are going to grab your attention, and so is the violent protest.
Yeah, and I mean, it leads back to what Puhiza was saying, though, because how else is our attention supposed to be grabbed?
Exactly, yeah.
And in the Black Lives Matter protest, without these, like, really intense videos, it would not have gained as much traction, and it wouldn't have been able to lead people to feel inclined to do more research on their own.
Especially in an age where media is so important for social movements and sort of the grabbing of attention of other people and the success of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I want to bring something contrary, or, like, not very common here. But the fact that these movements are being international and are being super famous, or, like, just targeted to a lot of places, does it really make a difference? Because, for example, in India, I mean, I personally didn't hear about it before much, although it was super huge. But in the end, the fact that social, or, like, it wasn't as big as in social media, it wasn't in my TikTok, it wasn't in my feed, it didn't really matter for the movement to be successful. They still actually managed to reach their goal and overturn the law or the bill, whatever was passed already for the government. So I'm just thinking, if the Black Lives Matter was so famous and social media makes us this feeling that we're super engaged, it's crossing borders, it's big, famous doesn't equal result, does it?
Yeah, we can make the claim that the farmers' movement was more successful because we're able to see more tangible changes. However, this is kind of because the movement was fighting for its specific change of getting rid of the laws. So, yeah, while it also tied to the deeper fight for democracy, the goal of the protest was pretty binary. Where if we're looking at the case of the Black Lives Matter movement, which was super popular, yes, the situation at hand was fighting against the mistreatment of Black Americans through social norms, systematic imbalance, and police brutality of things that have been going on for decades. So it's not going to elicit one solution that we're able to celebrate afterwards. The movement was actually very successful in promoting the change in society as well as policy reform, And these changes shouldn't be undermined, because even though they're not as satisfying as what the farmers' movement was able to show to us, they were certainly impactful differences, and they're continuing to move forward. And it was able to reach an international audience as well because of this popularity, which we can see, like, in the UK, for example, because they also had their own protests that started going up and around, and more than 260 towns and cities had anti-racism protests throughout June and July, and there were demonstrations, including the getting rid of statues of slave traders that were being, like, shown in a positive light, and these were really big anti-racism protests that were in Britain for the first time in decades. So I would say yes, the popularity definitely does make a difference in its effectiveness in creating change.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that Black Lives Matter, it was a lot more difficult to see the change. There was some change. Some states defunded the police, but of course it's a systematic issue. I think on top of that, BLM, Black Lives Matter, is much more easily spread across borders because it is a systematic issue that is mirrored in several states. Like, the same inequalities and racism and just kind of structural violence perpetuates itself in other countries as well, which makes it a lot easier to engage with the concepts of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And that really helped in its sort of international spread across media platforms. Whereas in India, it's a really specific case. You can't exactly parallel it to other countries across the world. And so we really see that just in terms of success or in terms of its ability to spread internationally, Black Lives Matter is a lot more conducive to that merely because of the concept. And thus, there's sort of a maybe a divide we can see in our analysis of how media played a role, because we have to also look at the content of the protests and not just how each state interacted and how the below state actors interacted with the media.
Yeah, to me, it seems that it's a strategy if you want a protest to be successful. Well, first, it's different success, right? For Black Lives Matter, completely different. And for the farmers in India, completely different what success means. But it's a strategy that you have to adjust based on your political circumstances. If you're living in a very democratic or you're living in a very media-censored place, you have to make your strategy go all the way around it in what sort of media it's used in one place or another. Like, Twitter is not such a thing in Kosovo, for example. I don't think a movement starting on Twitter would make such a big deal. Or, for example, in places where TikTok is censored. Like, I think you really need to find a way through this and see what will work better in each case. However, I'm still questioning in my mind if the fact that something becomes popular and just because it's more loud doesn't necessarily mean it's reaching the goals. Like, I'm thinking my whole engagement with Black Lives Matter throughout this time, did it really matter for the US that somebody in Kosovo like me is posting all the time about this? What do you think? I mean, you were both US citizens.
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually like to first respond to your first point about sort of the US culture of engagement with platforms like Twitter and social mm-hmm. media, which differs in other places. And really, I think key to this discussion that we shouldn't forget is that these companies, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, they're US-based companies.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have much more power in media. I mean, the US news salience is just higher because it owns these companies. Mm-hmm. People interact exactly. with it more. The US is dictating the narrative, and thus issues arising in the US are going to have a greater spread, mm-hmm. regardless of parallel situations
That's
that we
a
mentioned.
Good point.
But sorry, to bring it back to your second point, which was, does it matter whether, you know, somebody in, for example, Kosovo thinks or supports Black Lives Matter? I think I would argue that it does. I would argue that even if there's not systemic changes in Kosovo in terms of racial inequalities, the growing narrative surrounding inequalities is helpful for people around the world. And we can't say for sure, but, you know, maybe it leads to subsequent movements that are more case-specific, or it allows just greater discussion internationally. And I don't think there's necessarily a negative to that in this case.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not harming. So in yeah. this case, it's helping.
But maybe, Simply you know, it doesn't support Black Lives Matter that much if somebody in Kosovo is like, yeah, Black Lives Matter.
I mean, maybe if it was only the person in Kosovo and not the rest of them, yeah. But because it's just one member joining a larger group of people yeah. that are fighting for a cause.
Yeah.
And I'd actually be yeah. really curious. I mean, I don't have the answer, but I think a really interesting research to bring in whenever you're analyzing social movements is Erica Chenoweth's talk she did on TED. Can highly recommend watching it for anyone listening. And she kind of analyzes what percent participation rate you need from the population. And it's actually only 3, which is pretty low. But I would be curious to see how international support kind of alters this number, or if it alters this number, or how this kind of research will evolve and change in a world where media is entirely globalized and people in Kosovo can be supporting Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
But no answer on that, just question.
We'll find out, yeah.
I mean, also what I just remembered, for internationally speaking, India's case had international involvement, but people in San Francisco and California were engaging with it, but in a different way. So not just through a post in Instagram, but they were actually going into the streets of San Francisco.
Yeah, they protested in front of the Indian embassy in California, and they would make footage and be FaceTiming their relatives back in India and just showing their support. So maybe the personal connections didn't have like an external result, but it definitely felt a charge in the movement to keep going. And
yeah, it seems like wherever the protest is, there's a need to make it more global. Like, there's a need to make it more international, although in different ways. Like, for Black Lives Matter, the need was to spread it in all social medias. For India, was to call all Indians in all the places to see what and to fight for what's happening in their own country. And perhaps not only Indians, but also other citizens in San Francisco joined. So I think it's just a matter of the way of expression. Is it through a hashtag, or is it through actually going into the streets and camping, or going marching to the US, to the Indian embassy in the US?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, just briefly, I think in an interdependent world, the views of other states towards a state that's potentially violating human rights are incredibly critical. A very random example that we haven't mentioned here would be in Thailand, there's a lot of modern day slavery on fishing ships. And this was sort of brought to the international sphere. And then the buyers of the fish that were fished on the ships were Norway and Sweden, and they actually stopped buying from Thailand. So the international perception of a violation of human rights is incredibly critical in an interdependent world.
Yeah, totally.
And thus, like, social media movements and greater media awareness can potentially create some sort of pressure, whether it's hard economic power or soft power, on a state. So
totally.
For sure.
Okay, then I think let's go ahead and sort of conclude this topic. If anybody has any final thoughts, thank you. We're really grateful that you listened to our podcast. We spent this time talking about the movements in India and the Farmers Indian protests, as well as the Black Lives Matters movement, how media was differently portrayed in each one, how each actor interacted with media, what this meant in terms of violence or just the spread internationally, and kind of how this might change in the future.
Yeah,
I think what came up from this discussion with you guys in my mind is that definitely all social movements right now need a platform of media. Whatever they use depends on the specific content of what the protest is about, depend on where it's taking place. However, we shouldn't just say, because we're so involved with social media and because we spread all this information now, everything is super effective and media can solve the entire social movement's goal. And I'm thinking of this and I'm reflecting on myself, on how much I am active in my social media regarding the Palestine situation right now. It makes me feel like I'm helping to this, or I'm doing something so great. I'm just posting all the time. I'm telling how bad the human rights violations are. But then, is this just a delusional of me thinking I'm helping when I'm actually not, and the situation has not stopped whatsoever? Like, this movement in Palestine has crossed borders and borders. It has become in all social media as a thing. It has become in all countries a protest camping thing in several colleges. And yet, the situation is not changing. So I think we should be careful of how media makes us feel that we're super engaging when we're the saviors of the world. Mm. Well, to actually change something, it takes much more effort.
I mean, I think it's definitely a coping mechanism for a lot of people to engage on social media, because they're receiving so much information. And previously, we would never know so graphically what is going on so far away from us. And now that we have this, like, firsthand, like, visual of what's going on, it feels complacent to do absolutely nothing. So the only outlet that we have is to repost it or to post some kind of petition and go to a protest. So it's definitely a coping mechanism for our generation to use our platforms in that way, because that's what we're receiving. And so we have to kind of pass it forward.
And there's a power in that as well. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement gained power because people shared it via post. But I think, you know, there's a limit to it. There's a point at which there's a lack of physical action and maybe an extreme amount of social media interaction. And this then, I guess, is just something that we have to question within ourselves, like checking in and asking ourselves, is this really useful? And what could I be doing in addition to posting, in addition to being aware and making others aware?
That's a very good point. And I mean, in this podcast, we only presented two cases, but there's so many others and there's so many different ways of engaging. But we just wanted to bring light to these two different ones.
Yeah. And I think media is just the way that we're holding conversations nowadays. But before, it was even helpful for people to have conversations in their own personal families about things that were going on around the world. And maybe that didn't have a direct impact on it, but now we're just doing it through the lens of social media.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, our bubble that we can influence is just bigger.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
Powerful and wonderful. And we're so much more aware and we advocate to a much greater extent for human rights than we ever could have in an age without media, despite its biases and its flaws that we've talked about today. Mm-hmm. And
I guess this is how we communicate under a globalized world.
Okay, well then, thank you very much for listening. It's been a joy to speak here with you guys.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.